As of this morning, hundreds of thousands of Americans facing foreclosure are in a kind of limbo. That's because some of the nation's biggest banks have put evictions on hold while they sort out questions about the foreclosure process. One of the issues involves robo-signers. Those are workers at loan servicing firms who sign stacks of legal documents without personally verifying the accuracy of those documents. But the problem goes beyond that. There are now questions about who owns the loans and who has standing to foreclose. NPR's Tamara Keith joins us to sort some of this out. Good morning.
Good morning.
Let's start with those robo-signers. How big, how serious is that problem?
Well, to hear the banks tell it, this is just a technical issue, a paperwork problem. They say the facts are all correct. Someone checked everything, just not the people who were signing the documents. But 50 state attorneys general launched an investigation this week, and some are making it very clear that they think this isn't just a situation where banks made mistakes. They think it's fraud. So analysts out there who follow the banking industry, they seem to be split on just how bad this could be for the banks. One said the delays that will be involved in fixing this could cost the banks $6 to $10 billion. Others have different figures, and depending on who you ask, this could either be a blip or the start of some sort of housing Armageddon.
Okay, many of these firms have halted foreclosure actions while they sort out the paperwork. Will struggling homeowners actually get a break because of this?
In the short term, at least, some homeowners will get a reprieve while the paperwork is fixed. They'll be able to stay in their homes. But the loan servicing companies insist that the underlying circumstances that led to the foreclosures, those are not in question. Here's an example. J.P. Morgan Chase says that on average, when a home is sold in a foreclosure sale, the borrower hasn't made a payment in 14 months. J.P. Morgan Chase's CEO, Jamie Dimon, he put it pretty bluntly in an earnings call on Wednesday.
We've known there are issues in the mortgage business. And, you know, but for the most part, by the time you get to the end of the process, you know, we're not evicting people who deserve to stay in the house.
And in many cases, these homeowners have actually given up and moved out before the foreclosure sale ever happened. People I've spoken with, even consumer advocates, say it's unlikely we're going to find a bunch of people who were current on their mortgages who were getting foreclosed because a robo-signer didn't verify the documents.
So, Tamara, the idea here is that the banks will fix the documents, get good signatures, and then resubmit everything.
And that's what the banks are saying, and they're working on it. But there are a couple of complications. One is that in many states, these faulty documents were submitted to courts where there are judges who might not look too kindly on false affidavits. And also, some of those faulty documents were documents that said, we know who owns this mortgage, we're working as their agent, therefore we have the right to foreclose. But legal experts we've been talking to say they may not actually be able to prove that there are some complications. In most cases, these mortgages were packaged into securities and sold to investors. But in the process of packaging and selling and reselling, the ownership of these mortgages changed hands numerous times. And in some cases, and we have absolutely no idea how many cases, the paper trail is faulty. It fell apart. So who owns the loan and who has the right to foreclose could become very difficult to prove in some instances.
It certainly sounds like this is going to drag on.
Yes, it's going to take a long time and a ton of lawyers to figure this thing out. There are lawsuits all over the country. The thing is, the banks say that these affidavit problems are a technicality, and they could be correct in that. But it's also throwing the whole system into disorder.
Tamara, thanks so much.
Thank you.
NPR's Tamara Keith.
As a director, the 80-year-old Clint Eastwood isn't even close to hanging up his six-shooter. With more than 30 features under his belt, his latest is the supernatural drama Hereafter, starring Matt Damon. The script is by Peter Morgan, who wrote The Queen and Frost Nixon. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
In Clint Eastwood's Hereafter, three people in three countries have close personal encounters with death and subsequently find it impossible to connect with the living. And the film follows each character in turn until they finally meet. I won't say what happens when they do, but I thought of Gertrude Stein's unjust verdict on Oakland. There is no there there. Oh, there is a hereafter in the film, a life beyond this world. You see that in the first 10 minutes. But the movie itself is hung up in a kind of twilight zone, too mawkish and lame to make a decent ghost story, too contrived to tell us anything enlightening about how to live in the shadow of death. The film ends small, but starts really, really big, with a tsunami crashing into a Pacific beach resort and carrying off, among others, Cécile de France's French TV reporter, Marie. The sequence is fast, tight, and convincingly real. But when Marie gets conked on the head and stops breathing, she has a vision of the tidal realm. And it's dismayingly tacky and threadbare, a whitish void in which streaky human silhouettes stare into the camera. Yes, it's better than the other extreme, Peter Jackson's effects-heavy post-mortem playhouse in The Lovely Bones. But it suggests all the same that the dead have nothing better to do than stand around waiting for people to poke their heads in. Or for someone like Matt Damon's George to carry messages from one side to the other. George is Hereafter's second protagonist. He gave up a lucrative career as a medium, talking to the dead. But his brother, Billy, played by Jay Moore, continues to bring colleagues to see him.
Another person came to see me for a reading. Thanks to your friend, Mr. Andrea.
What? Look, I'll have a talk with him, make sure nothing like that ever happens again, okay? And
what?
Did you do it?
What?
The reading. Did you do the reading?
You still don't get it, do you? You think just because I can make money doing this, just because I can, that I should do it?
Yeah. Yeah, I do. I also think you have a duty to do it because you have a gift.
It's not a gift, Billy. It's a curse.
When he communicates with the dead, George sounds like a typically bogus cold reader. He says things like, "I'm seeing a woman with dark hair, is that right?" But he's supposed to be the real McCoy, a man who can grasp someone's hand and see that tacky whitish void in which streaky human silhouettes stare into the camera. The third protagonist is Marcus, a working-class London boy whose twin brother gets run over by a car. Snatched from his junky mom and placed in foster care, Marcus googles in anguish for someone to help him talk to his brother, preferably, since he's so needy, on a daily basis. That's where the movie meanders for a long hour, with Marcus trying to see the dead, George trying not to see them, and Marie wandering around visiting researchers, asking whether she saw what she thinks she saw. A scientist played by Marta Keller, who claims once to have been an atheist, tells her, "The evidence is irrefutable." The evidence, of course, is thoroughly refutable, but you can be a card-carrying skeptic like me and still enjoy comedies like Ghost Town, or horror pictures like Poltergeist, or even sappy romantic thrillers like Ghost. Not Hereafter, though. Peter Morgan's script is credulous in the most simplistic, sentimental way imaginable. He says he wrote it after losing a close friend in an accident and longing to make contact with the other side. So he creates a world in which there seems to be some kind of conspiracy to keep us all from knowing the dead have messages for us, messages that boil down to forget about us and live your life. Good advice. It's a long decrescendo of a movie, directed in Eastwood's patented laconic style that sometimes works and sometimes, like here, is dull and impersonal. The solemn, guitar-heavy score Eastwood wrote doesn't liven things up, and neither does Damon, who's glumly self-effacing, until the bewildering final scene, in which George is suddenly able to see the future as well as the dead. Hereafter closed the New York Film Festival and has been hailed in some quarters as a masterly summing up of Eastwood's long career, which is kind of alarming. They're raving about him as if he's already given up the ghost.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Shorrock. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Melody Kramer is our associate producer of online media. Sue Spolin directed the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Linda Wertheimer. A small Pennsylvania company is celebrating its role in this week's successful rescue of 33 miners in Chile. Center Rock Incorporated made the drilling equipment used to reach the trapped men. Jennifer Sveta Jordan of station WYEP reports.
Before this week, Berlin, Pennsylvania was really only known outside its borders for Snyder's brand potato chips. Then a drill bit manufacturer with just 80 employees put all hands on deck to save the 33 miners a half a world away.
All the bits that we ran were all made right here in record pace. These guys, everybody just dropped what they were doing and worked round the clock till they got us everything we needed.
Richard Soppy markets the drills for Center Rock Incorporated. It's in a nondescript industrial shop in the middle of a cornfield. As soon as Soppy heard of the mine collapse, he knew his company could help. Center Rock's drill heads have bits that pound rock as the drill rotates, ideal for the hard, dry volcanic ground where the miners were stuck. Soppy started calling Pennsylvania officials and others to convince them their equipment could save the day. After getting the go-ahead, Soppy and other employees headed off to Chile. They worked days at a time until they literally fell asleep standing up. After 33 days, it paid off.
The miners had a camera pointed up in the roof, and it just mud and muck and water raining down. And all of a sudden, we saw that nose of that drill, and it was a defining moment. The two other drills that were drilling simultaneously, they stopped and saluted us, and it was the biggest moment of my life.
The pace is getting back to normal at the shop now. All around the offices are thank you letters, signs reading 33 lives, and notes from kids welcoming home what they call their heroes. Soppy's ready for some rest. Today, though, he'll allow the town of Berlin to pat him and the others on the back as area businesses hold a party for their hometown company.
I don't think it's all sunk in yet. What we did, it was pretty big. Nothing like it ever before in the world, and I'm proud to be a part of the team that went down there and got it done.
For NPR News, I'm Jennifer Sveta Jordan.
Before Lady Gaga, before Elton John, there was Liberace. People of a certain age will remember the candelabra on his piano, the flamboyant costumes, even the self-deprecating humor in his distinctive voice.
My clothes may look funny, but they're making me the money.
At one point, thanks to performing in Las Vegas, Liberace was the highest paid entertainer in the world. And he created a museum that bears his name, which was once among the most visited attractions in Vegas. Those days are gone, and so few people visit the Liberace Museum. It's closing on Sunday. NPR's Ted Robbins hurried over before it was too late.
Maybe this is just one more story about how Vegas is constantly changing. But maybe not. After all, Sinatra is still Sinatra. Elvis still has impersonators performing here. So what happened to Liberace? Marion Blank saw him decades ago, and she still remembers his charisma, personality, and showmanship.
It was really a spectacular show. He came on in a car and all glitzed up as he usually is. And it was just a wonderful experience.
She came from Indiana for one last visit to the Liberace Museum to see the outrageous costumes, like a black mink cape lined with 40,000 Swarovski crystals, the over-the-top cars, including a Rolls-Royce covered in little mirrors, and the piano collection featuring a mirror-encrusted Baldwin Grand. That's a recording of Liberace playing the Baldwin. He was classically trained, but Liberace wanted to please the masses. He said he played classical without the boring parts. Classipop, museum archivist Jerry Goldberg calls it. It made Liberace famous.
But the biggest problem was you didn't leave humming or singing his music because he played other people's music. His name more or less has died out because there's nothing to associate him with except the bling and showmanship.
His biggest fans were middle-aged women in the 1950s through the 1970s, a shrinking demographic. Liberace might have become a gay icon, Goldberg says. Lots of people, including his own mother, knew Liberace was gay.
A lot of people knew. His mother was aware of his lifestyle, but back then it would have been a catastrophe for his career. So he never admitted it, even up to the day he died. Never came out of the closet.
But the biggest problem for the Liberace Museum may be its location. It's more than 2 miles off the Vegas Strip, and visitors just don't want to make the trip. Though now that it's closing, locals like Katie Driscoll are coming.
My mother watched Liberace all the time when I was growing up and played the piano, and so did I. And I moved here, became a showgirl, and heard that it was closing, and I didn't want to miss it.
Then there's Philip Balian. When he heard the Liberace Museum was closing, he got on a plane to Vegas from London.
I watched him as a child on television and saw him play, and I said to my parents, I'd like to learn to play the piano. I want to be like that guy there with the sparkly jacket.
Philip Balian learned to play the piano. No sparkly jacket, but now on his first trip to the States, he is thrilled that the museum staff let him play Liberace's mirror-encrusted grand piano for the final visitors. After Sunday, the piano and the other artifacts here will go into storage, and Liberace's fame will fade a little further. Ted Robbins, NPR News, Las Vegas.
We're going to talk for a few more minutes about the so-called prosperity gospel. And part of the reason that the issue is in the spotlight is that megachurch pastor Bishop Eddie Long, who's associated with that tradition, has been in the news because of lawsuits alleging inappropriate personal conduct with members of his congregation. But long before that happened, he was known for his opulent lifestyle and for a message that strong faith leads to material wealth. And here's just a short clip of Bishop Long.
God said, let me tell you something. We're in Las Vegas now. Because I want you to take a risk with me. Matter of fact, the deal is good on the front side. Because I'm the one that gives you the ability to get wealth. I give you 100% and only ask for 10% back. And then I'm going to take your 10% and protect your 90%. And then if you're sowing a tithe of an offering, I'm going to give you 30, 60, 100-fold over that. I think that's a good deal.
Now, as we said earlier, many people have criticized this theological perspective and practice from outside of the church, but now a prominent critic has come forward from inside the church. In a recent op-ed in the Wall Street Journal, DeForest Sorries, pastor of the First Baptist Church of Lincoln Gardens in Somerset, New Jersey, takes on prosperity gospel as dysfunctional and leading people into habits that are not going to lead to success in the rest of their lives. We caught up with him yesterday to talk more about what he has to say.
I have been concerned about this for a long time. My church is involved in helping about 400 people who are losing their homes avoid foreclosure. In some instances, we've bought houses that people were losing and let them stay in the house and pay us rent. We've seen the way people live. We've seen people with high interest rates, low credit scores, and it doesn't help when people who are struggling and drowning financially have a minister that they hold in high esteem convince them to send him $1,000, and then God will send them three. And this prosperity gospel has taken advantage of cable television and radio now to the extent that it looks mainstream. Many people, because they're desperate, are now flocking to ministries like these, and we think it's religious poison. And so rather than simply talk about it among ourselves, a few of us have decided that it's prudent to say something out loud. Our silence gives tacit approval to that kind of ministry.
Well, you know, to that point, your church, the First Baptist Church of Lincoln Gardens, is the focus of the newest CNN Black in America special, Almighty Debt, and the program follows three families from your church who've fallen on hard times financially. Was it a difficult decision to kind of open up the conversation? You know, there are those who are, you know, often very sensitive about what they perceive as airing dirty laundry to the larger society.
Well, it was difficult primarily because I just don't like that much attention. We have enough work to do without attention, and attention just brings more work. Having said that, our dirty laundry is quite public already. And I think silence in the face of injustice is worse than the injustice itself. And it is unfortunate that much of the injustice is perpetrated by people with robes on.
You know, this has always been a very interesting tension. But I think a lot of people have always been, you know, puzzled by how it is that you can have these religious figures who profess the gospel and yet live these extremely opulent lifestyles. The question I have for you, because you write in your op-ed, to their credit, some prosperity ministers like Bishop T.D. Jakes of the Potter's House in Dallas and Dr. Ivy Hilliard of the New Light Christian Center in Houston have motivated many people to avoid the traps of thinking of themselves as permanent victims and to defy conventional stereotypes. The prosperity gospel says that everyone can succeed financially, regardless of race or gender or class, and the prosperity movement has effectively changed life expectations for millions of people. So the question I have for you is, well, what crosses the line then between something that encourages people to think of themselves as people of efficacy, and then what crosses the line to what you consider exploitative behavior, which sells people a bill of goods, which they're never going to be able to actually pay?
Well, in the Bible, some fellows approached Jesus and asked Jesus if he was the real thing. And Jesus said, come walk with me. And he showed them the fruit of his labor, the result of his work, and then said, you decide for yourself. What crosses the line is the fruit of our labor. T.D. Jakes happens to have more assistance available for people in prison, and when they get out of prison, than most denominations. And so when you look at the fruit of his labor, you see that prosperity, which is not a bad thing, is just a part of a larger package. But when an entire ministry is dedicated to raising more money so that it can raise more money, and the only person benefiting is the person at the top, that's what I call an ecclesiastical pyramid scheme. You know, when I was coming along, Michelle, if someone called me Reverend Ike, those were fighting words. The whole idea that a preacher would be labeled Reverend Ike suggested that he cared about himself only. Reverend Ike's mantra was that his contribution to poverty was eliminating one person from it, and that person was himself. There are guys today on television that make Reverend Ike look moderate.
Like one. Name one.
Robert Tilton. Robert Tilton is a so-called televangelist who was discovered to have gotten prayer requests accompanied by money. And then when an investigative reporter went behind his church, he found all of those prayer requests dumped, unopened. The checks were cashed, but the prayer requests weren't open. And so I just think we have got to be clear about the difference between prosperity as a holistic concept and prosperity, which is essentially an ATM machine for preachers who know how to capitalize on people's pain.
But how would they know who is authentically interested in their well-being and who is just enriching himself, particularly people who have no financial literacy? How are they to judge?
You can watch certain people on television, and for the entire time, all they do is ask for money. You can go into some churches, and they'll ask you to line up based on how much you give. And when you hear a preacher or any leader say to you, if you can't afford to pay your rent Friday, you give us $1,000 today on Sunday, and by Friday, God will bring all of the money to your house that you need. Common sense says there's something wrong with this picture. The fact is, I'm not against prosperity ministry if by prosperity we mean teaching people the value of education, helping people live on a budget. I mean, 80% of the American people don't live on a budget. 52% of black people admit that they are regularly late on paying their bills. And so when I've got people in my church driving $75,000 cars, paying 29% interest, and they make $35,000 a year, that is a fundamental problem. And rather than focus on how they can help me make more money, I believe my calling is to focus on how to help them better manage their money.
DeForest Sorries Jr. is senior pastor of the First Baptist Church of Lincoln Gardens in Somerset, New Jersey, and he was kind enough to join us from his home office. Pastor Sorries, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Michelle.